WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning and happy Friday, everybody. I heard an interesting analysis the other day of why Americans are so ready to go back to quote-unquote normal and live with hundreds of thousands of COVID deaths again this year. Even with the 1 million deaths the country has now suffered in total, and let's say each of those people leaves behind 10 loved ones, that's 10 million people, 11 million people out of our nation of 330 million. So the vast, vast majority has not been touched by COVID death. And so the politics of protection don't add up in this theory. Many more have been touched by COVID rules that they don't like, and that's one explanation for statements like this that we're about to play from Mayor Adams this week. Now, after he raised the official COVID status of New York City to high alert because of how fast it's spreading right now, he was asked by a reporter why he's not reinstituting mask or vaccine requirements for indoor public places other than the subways and the buses. And remember, as you hear this clip, that nobody is asking about shutdowns, only mask and vaccine standards for protecting vulnerable people while remaining open.
If every variant that comes, we move into shutdown thoughts, we move in through panicking, we're not going to function as a city. And so I feel extremely pleased based on my analysis in the morning with my health experts that we are being extremely strategic and we are fighting COVID with not only the tools that we didn't have before, but we're also fighting COVID using the intelligence we need to win in a COVID environment.
Mayor Adams at a news conference on Wednesday. We'll start there today. And also talk about rebounding from Paxlovid. That's a new thing people are experiencing. We'll touch on monkeypox and more with Caitlin Jedalina, creator of the Substack newsletter called Ask an Epidemiologist. She's also an adjunct professor of epidemiology at the University of the newsletter is called Your Local Epidemiologist. Sorry about that. Your Local Epidemiologist. Let me get that exactly right. And she teaches at the University of Texas. Professor Jedalina, thanks for coming on with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
And listeners, here's why I got confused. It's because I'm about to give you this invitation to ask an epidemiologist, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And again, that epidemiologist is Caitlin Jedalina, author of the Substack blog newsletter called Your Local Epidemiologist. So let me start here, Professor Jedalina. With the current Omicron infection surge, you wrote a post titled, Are We in a Public Health Emergency? Why did you frame the question that way?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's this interesting, very challenging phase right now of the pandemic, which has really sparked this intense tug of war between pushing towards normalcy and the pushback towards urgency from others. And, you know, where one stands on this spectrum from urgency to normalcy is really centered around that one question, that person's answer to whether we're in a public health emergency. Is what we're experiencing today considered a manageable situation, or is it still an emergency as a definition of epidemic? And I think that this can't just be answered epidemiologically, but it's also answered psychology, you know, culturally, politically, and even morally. And so it's very difficult, particularly in the United States, to truly know where the public is right now.
So how do you answer the question? Are we in a health emergency?
Well, as an epidemiologist, I would say, yeah, you know, an epidemic or an emergency is defined as cases of disease above which we normally expect. And if we just look at deaths alone, yeah, they are plummeting, which is great news due to immunity and due to our treatments. But what is considered acceptable? We're still experiencing about 300 deaths a day. And if we add this all up, it's COVID-19 will still be the third leading cause of disease in the United States this year.
The third leading cause of death in the United States?
I'm sorry, yes. Third leading cause of death in the United States this year. And it has been the past 2 years. And to me, that's just not an acceptable level for SARS-CoV-2.
We talk about deaths being down compared to the first Omicron wave, and I guess to the original wave 2 years ago, but it's still hundreds of people every day in this country, as you just said. But how does that compare, say, to the worst flu season in recent times? Because people say, well, yeah, we just have to treat it like the flu and go about our business the way we always went our business, knowing that people die from the flu every year in substantial numbers. So I see you retweeted some of those numbers just the other day.
I did. So I looked back till 2014 to see what were the number of deaths. And the worst flu season was from 2017 to 2018, and we lost 61,000 people due to the flu, which is terrible in and of itself. And if we compare this to the first 5 months of 2022, we already surpassed this number by more than twofold. We have experienced about 162,000 deaths from SARS-CoV-2. And so we are already very much higher than the flu, and we think this will be sustained throughout the year as well.
And I just did the math on 300 deaths a day, which is where the country is roughly right now. That's considered low, and multiply it by 365, that's over 100,000 deaths. That's around 110,000 deaths for COVID for this year if it continues at that pace.
That's right. And that's assuming that this continues at this pace. That we know that SARS-CoV-2 is mutating extremely quickly because it's jumping from person to person very quickly. And so that is quote unquote best case scenario. Now, if we have another Omicron-like event in which this virus significantly mutates to escape even more immunity, the high estimate of deaths this year would be closer to about 480,000. Hmm. So it's a wide range, and we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know where we'll land, but to me, even that low number is unacceptable.
Nobody wants or is asking for shutdowns anymore, but I played that Eric Adams clip where he invoked shutdowns and panic in response to a question from a reporter about mask and vaccine requirements for indoor public spaces. It's really a very specific and limited question that he was asked. Do you see an epidemiological mismatch between the state of the pandemic and the state of pandemic politics?
I do. We know that this virus has very high transmission levels right now across the United States. And we know what works. Science tells us we know masks work. We know vaccines work to reduce transmission. And if we all leverage these tools on a systematic level, there's no doubt we would get this a lot more under control than it currently is.
What's the epidemiology of vaccines reducing transmission? You just said we know that vaccines reduce transmission, but so many vaccinated people spread COVID to other vaccinated people these days that the public gets confused.
That's right. And Omicron really changed the game with this, I will say. So there's really two ways someone can spread the virus. First is, or the vaccine helps reduce transmission, is first that vaccines, and particularly boosters with Omicron, and that's the really big important difference, is that if you're boosted, the viral particles that try to find the host are quickly destroyed. So you don't even get infected in the first place. This is called sterilizing immunity, which of course then reduces transmission. But even if you are a breakthrough case, say you do get infected, even if you're boosted, the vaccine still kicks in. It makes the breakthrough cases less contagious than unvaccinated cases. And it does that by, one, clearing the virus faster. So the vaccinated are contagious for far fewer days than the unvaccinated, as well as it reduces the number of infectious particles. So, for example, even if the viral load is the same between vaccinated and unvaccinated, that doesn't necessarily mean the number of infectious viral particles are the same. And we see that it is significantly reduced among the vaccinated. So yeah, vaccines are not perfect. We see quite a few breakthrough cases, and we'll see more with Omicron changing. But we do know that boosters reduce transmission well, and will no doubt help with community transmission.
Just before we go to some phone calls, and listeners, if you're just joining us, my guest is Caitlin Jedalina, creator of the Substack newsletter called Your Local Epidemiologist and a professor of epidemiology at the University of Texas. So she's not really our local epidemiologist here in the New York area, but Your Local Epidemiologist is the name of her really excellent newsletter, and she is an epidemiologist, PhD epidemiologist. You can ask an epidemiologist your COVID epidemiology question at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post it online on Twitter, tweet it at Brian Lehrer. But before we go to calls, I wish I could remember who said that thing on TV that I quoted at the top about the politics of COVID reopenings right now. Even with the numbers we've been discussing, the small percentage of people actually touched by a COVID death close to them, a million deaths, let's say 10 million mourners, compared to 330 million people in the United States, almost all of which have been touched and aggravated by a COVID requirement. Think there's anything to that in terms of a political analysis?
I think that it can get political very easily. And, you know, politics should not be correlated with deaths. But unfortunately, we are seeing that in the United States. It's incredibly tragic. I think it's a national tragedy, the number of avenues due of mis and disinformation, and how that has equated to about 350,000 preventable deaths in the United States. And so, you know, yeah, I think that we need to learn our lessons from the past. But going forward, it's not just about getting vaccines very quickly. It's not just about finding effective treatments, but it's also figuring out a way to communicate clearly, as well as fight misinformation along the way so this doesn't happen again.
Here's, I'll call it a baseball game epidemiology question from a listener via Twitter. It says, at Citi Field yesterday, that's where the Mets play. They're one of our local baseball teams that's doing really, really well. So it says, at Citi Field yesterday, in the stands and even in the crowded, fairly enclosed concourse, among the thousands of people, I saw not a single person, not one, was wearing a mask except me, writes this listener. Trouble ahead, he concludes. How much risk do you think there is at an outdoor baseball stadium, pretty much all of them in the baseball popular cities, you know, being packed right now, like pre-pandemic?
Yeah, so we know that outdoor transmission is much more rare than indoor transmission, and that's because of ventilation. Think of it as like you're smoking a cigarette. That plume of smoke in the outdoors dissipates very quickly compared to indoors. And so outdoors is a lot less risky. I think the worry that I start getting at is when you are shoulder to shoulder in a massive crowd and maybe there isn't air ventilation. It gets very stagnant here at our Texas baseball fields. And so there's going to be risk there. I think that everyone right now needs to weigh their risk tolerance and unfortunately make decisions on an individual level basis on what they are and are not willing to accept.
Lori in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lori.
Hey, good morning. I'm a mom of a public school child, and I wanted to ask your expert opinion on why there's no redo of the mask requirement. It had been required in public schools. That's been done away with. There's a huge increase. Everyone I know is getting sick. My kid was able to get through it, but he just came down with COVID. You know, you don't have an option to show up at school. And if you want to wear a mask, that's fine, but others don't have to. So in your expert opinion, why is there even like, let's an updated red alert if there's nothing being translated to an action, particularly in New York City public schools? That's my question. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And that is another news story today, the uptick in cases being reported at public schools in New York City. So, Professor, what would you say to this mom?
Yeah, so I'm a mom of two little kids as well. And I don't know why. I think that it is very practical to reinstate mask mandates, especially given the really high levels of transmission. And given that even with the new CDC guidance, a lot of New York is now in the highest threat level, according to the CDC. I do know, though, that we are living in a very individualized culture in the United States. And so a lot of pressure is being put on the individuals to make their own decisions. And I as an epidemiologist, I always think of populations. So I don't necessarily agree with that perspective. But I do know that masks protect the wearer, not just those around us. And especially if the mask is well fit and well filtered. So even if your kid is the only one wearing a mask at the school, it's a very good bubble for around them. And then two, the vaccines are just incredible. They are really holding up very well against severe disease and death. And I think that we can put a lot of trust in those as well. So I don't agree with it, but I do know that we have lots of layers of mitigation we can take on the individual level to continue to protect ourselves.
What is the epidemiology now of one-way masking as being protective? I think some people remember the very beginning of the pandemic when at first we were told not to mask ourselves because masks were needed for the healthcare workers who were really in an emergency situation and there wouldn't have been enough masks to go around at the beginning. And one of the things that the experts seemed to be saying at that time was, well, masks are really to prevent COVID from leaving you. They don't really do much coming in. But I think either the science or the rhetoric has changed since then. So what does the science tell us? What does the epidemiology tell us 2 years into COVID?
Yeah, that's right. Our understanding of the virus continues to change because we're learning about it as we go. And so now that one, we recognize that SARS-CoV-2 is airborne, as well as transmitted through droplets, it makes masks even that more important. we know that on average, so if you take in cloth masks and surgical masks, and on average, masks reduce transmission by about 58%. That increases substantially if we all upgrade our masks to N95s, which is truly necessary right now with Omicron. And if you can't get your hands on an N95 or they're uncomfortable, KN94s and KF95s are just as good. And they protect about, and that's where the number comes, 95% of particles coming in. And so, again, they're not perfect, but if we start layering masks with vaccines and with air filtration and with using antigen tests, we are really putting a nice bubble around us.
So what's the epidemiology now of more transmissible, which we heard about Omicron originally compared to previous variants, and now we hear Omicron BA2, even more transmissible than the original Omicron. What's the functional epidemiology of that? Like, if I'm in an elevator for 45 seconds, that somebody else who was infected was just in before me, am I at risk?
That's a great question. I don't know if the actual time frame has been measured yet. I do know that once someone exhales, for example, in a bus, it takes about 45 seconds for everyone to be inhaling. So it's pretty quick. But again, it's very...
Wait, what does that mean? If somebody exhales in a bus, it takes about 45 seconds for what?
For everyone else to be inhaling it. Those particles.
To be for everyone else? In other words, for the particles to spread throughout a whole bus?
That's right. If it's not ventilated well, that it's that quick.
And if unmasked?
And if you're masked, it helps a lot. It helps filter about 95% of those. What also helps, and we already mentioned this in the beginning of the show, is vaccines with sterilizing immunity, and especially the boosters. They can act really fast and attack the virus before it reaches your cells, so you don't even get infected in the first place. And so it's a bit complicated question to answer, but it is possible if you're close to a very contagious person.
But in that bus example, when does it dissipate? Let's say that there's only one infected person on the bus, and then the person exits the bus, but they were breathing in there. And so you're saying 45 seconds after the last breath, everyone else in the bus would have been exposed, if I'm hearing you correctly. When does that dissipate?
Yeah, so we've seen some scientific studies in the lab. So this is not the real world, but in the lab, they can stay up in the air for about 16 hours. That's the maximum. Now, of course, ventilation and filtration and getting those bus windows open and the doors opening and people moving will change that. But in a sterile situation, it can stay up in the air for a long time.
16 hours? So if somebody was in a restaurant restroom, let's say, and was infected while they were breathing in there, there are going to be particles, there are going to be droplets or aerosols, I guess, in that bathroom that can infect the next vulnerable person for 16 hours?
Yes. Yeah. Think of it like a plummet of smoke. But yes, that certainly can happen.
Georgina in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Caitlin Jedalina, who writes the Your Local Epidemiologist Substack newsletter. Hi, Georgina. No, Georgina? All right, we'll take a break and then we'll continue. I do want to ask you about monkeypox. I do want to ask you about your post the other day about Paxlovid rebounding and what people who do go on Paxlovid should know about that. So stay with us, folks. We'll finish up with Caitlin Jedalina. A few more of your calls as well. Stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Caitlin Jedalina, creator of the Substack newsletter called Your Local Epidemiologist. She also teaches epidemiology at the University of Texas. And now I think we have Georgina in Manhattan on the line. Georgina, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey there, you're on WNYC. We can hear you.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. I have a question for the doctor, please. I have a very rare type of asthma for which I receive a biologic injection every 28 days, and I have other autoimmune issues, and I have been nothing less than religious about not only guarding other people but myself, of course, because I know COVID would kill me. There's no doubt in my mind. I'm getting my fifth shot, which will be my third booster on June 10th. But this is what I go through with the people who are, for whatever reason, it makes them feel powerful or authoritative or I don't know. But it's insulting to have somebody tell you that they were vaccinated twice. They got the two shots. I said, oh, which company's brand did you get? Oh, Johnson & Johnson. I can't tell you how many times I've met people who've lied about being vaccinated and who lie about, and then the other trick is they already had COVID, so that's their vaccine. You know,
that's their excuse. Oh, I had it, so I'm immune like a vaccinated person.
But what they're so willfully ignorant of is that the virus attacks the entire immune system if you're not vaccinated. Now, the mere fact that I have not contracted, although I've been very careful, because that's not how I want to die. And I know all about emergency rooms and not being able to breathe and since I'm 8 years old. Hmm. And I don't want to die with a ventilator down my throat. But I will tell you this. And I live in Manhattan. I remain appalled on a daily basis on people who don't care if they do any harm or not, and actually say to me, well, we invited you to dinner at Christmas time and at Thanksgiving time, and, you know, you wouldn't come. I said, well, it's not that I wouldn't come. I couldn't come because I couldn't put myself at risk. None of you in your family of eight have had a vaccine. And they said, well, we're waiting to get the virus, so we'll have our natural immunity. Yeah.
So, Georgina, let me ask you a question. As somebody who is as vulnerable as you apparently are, as immunocompromised as you are because of what you were describing before about your condition and your treatments, what do you think the rules of society should be to protect people in your position?
Well, you know, I think they could at least wear masks, in order to go to public school, we were all vaccinated. I vividly remember the day my lovely mother, I was only 3 or 4 years old, she put a sugar cube under my tongue at the high school football field. I'm one of nine children. And she said to me at the time, this goes under your tongue. This will give you a life. This will protect you. And, you know, I didn't know anybody.
One of the vaccines.
Yeah. The soft vaccine. And you know, so we had to have vaccines to go to school. But now, you know, for some reason, the virus that has killed 1 million people in 2 years, okay, in America, which doesn't come, I mean, it just far exceeds
right.
the 25,000
right.
flu deaths.
Right, and the vaccine is controversial, and the mandates that were normal when we all entered school, the modern equivalent for COVID is this politicized, controversial individual freedom thing. It's really just selfish, in my own opinion. I will say my own opinion. It's just selfish of people, unless they have certain medical reasons, not to get vaccinated against COVID. But Georgina, thank you for your story. Stay well, stay safe. And for you as an epidemiologist, Dr. Jedalina, and for people who are policymakers, even more, it's a tough set of decisions to make, right? What do we do as a society that's fair to the most vulnerable people like Georgina, and that also doesn't restrict the behavior of the vast majority of people who are not as vulnerable any more than we have to.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's incredibly tough. And you have to also balance that with pandemic fatigue. People are very tired of this. They're losing a lot of hope. And also, there's just no safety net or trust in the United States. And so all of this is making, like we said in the beginning of the show, a really tough landscape to navigate, not only for individuals, but how do we accept a new SARS-CoV-2 virus into our repertoire of threats? I guess I'm just glad I'm not the one making policy decisions right now.
The luxury of being an epidemiologist instead of a mayor or a governor or a president. All right, let me touch a couple of other things that you've written about before you go. You wrote a post called Rebounding After Paxlovid. Paxlovid, the antiviral drug that's being used much more for COVID in vulnerable people and apparently with a good deal of success. But what's this rebound effect?
Yeah, so we saw rebound. So what rebounding means is that after the start or after the end of treatment, someone quickly turns positive again. Their antigen test turns positive. And we actually saw this during the clinical trial. About 2% of participants in the clinical trial rebounded. But interestingly, also 1.5 participants in the placebo group also rebounded. And so
1.5%.
So we didn't think it was, there was really no statistical difference between 2% and 1.5. And so we didn't really think it was a big deal. But now that Paxlovid has been in the real world for a while, a lot of anecdotal evidence of rebounding is accumulating. And so we are trying to figure out real quickly if it's just 2%, and you know, 2% of a lot of people is a lot of people, or if something is happening maybe because of Omicron. That clinical trial was during Delta, so we know Omicron's very different. Or is it because people are getting the treatment too early, so they're not mounting a full response? So we have a lot of unanswered
questions.
Or
maybe need longer than a five-day course, which is the standard, to really knock it down. And by rebounding, we just mean the symptoms return after they had gone away?
That's right. The symptoms return and you test positive again on your antigen test.
And one of the stories in New York today is one case of confirmed monkeypox. Do you know what monkeypox even is?
I do. It is a cousin of smallpox. And it's been around since the 70s. It's endemic in West and Central Africa. And it's not unusual to have a case randomly pop up. But what's really unusual right now is how many cases are popping up across the globe, how many of those cases don't have a travel history, and how they're hundreds of miles away from each other. So this means that there's undetected community transmission and a high likelihood of more cases.
Why now?
That's a fantastic question. Either the virus has mutated or... what's more likely is our behaviors are changing. We actually expected an outbreak because since the eradication of smallpox and thus the end of smallpox vaccinations and waning immunity, we were going to start seeing increased number of monkeypox cases. And we combine this with more people exposed to monkeypox. It's a predictable stage for large outbreaks.
Does it have anything to do with monkeys?
Well, it did in the beginning. So the first animal case was a monkey, so hence the name. It was in the 1950s. But since then, we actually don't know the natural reservoir of monkeypox. We don't know where this virus calls home. We do know, though, that rodents and small mammals usually infect humans through scratches, bites, or hunting and eating wild animals.
Does it have epidemic potential? I heard that you have to have very close contact to get it from somebody.
You do. You have to, it's either transferred through droplets or bodily fluids or even indirect contact with like clothing or bedding. In the past, it's been not typically transmissible because it requires, you need a lot of the virus to become infected. And that's what's so puzzling right now, is because it seems like it's a little more transmissible than before. And so we really need to understand these cases a lot better through genomic sequencing, as well as epidemiological real-world data to figure out what's truly going on right now. This is not going to turn into the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic. It's a little too early to tell how worried we should be. But it's the reality we're living in, that, you know, the next epidemic is really just around the corner.
One more question from a listener. It says, hi, please ask your guest, if you are vaxxed and boosted and are exposed in your household to COVID but do not get it, does that function as another boost to your immunity? And that's related to another question, if that's a confusing way to put it. Another post asks, is exposure to a little bit of COVID immunizing?
Not necessarily. You need to be infected for your immune system to be activated. So if that person, it's not unusual for household members to not get infected. So household transmission of Omicron is about 30 to 50%. So that's not unusual. Now, if you know, are sure you weren't infected, so you weren't asymptomatic, the likelihood of you having hybrid immunity, which is the vaccine plus infection-induced immunity, is low. You do need to have an infection to mount the hybrid response.
Only about 30 to 50% of people who live with infected people get COVID themselves. Is that what you just said?
That's right. And boosters reduce that number. So usually, you know, if you're boosted, it reduces the likelihood of transmission in the household.
And there we leave it with Caitlin Jedalina, who writes the Substack newsletter, your local epidemiologist. Thank you for so much information. We really, really appreciate it. Let's do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.